Hazard of getting it wrong, I'll introduce myself today. Hi, I'm John Beck. I co-direct with my colleague Kurt Dewhurst our daily work, our daily lives, so it's great that you're all here. I'm sorry that I'm kind of pitch hitting. That went out to all of you who are on the email list. The original presentation that we're going to have today by Dylan Miner from the Residential College was on his art that has to do with the 1937 Flint sit-down strike. Unfortunately, that presentation got canceled, second year in a row. So luckily the strike originally was not canceled, it went on successfully, and that's why we now have the United Auto Workers. But as I indicated to some people when they asked, there's a lot in today's presentation on the auto workers. So if you're disappointed by the lack of the 37 sit-down strike, it's actually reflected at some point in my presentation today. But as usual, as I start, this time I'm handing around only next semester's list. And so if you look through that, our next brown bag is until January 18th. But you'll still get all my emails with calls for papers and other kind of information. We're currently working on an exhibit that our Daily Work of Daily Lives is going to be. We have two possible exhibits that we're working on. One is going to be in our foyer downstairs that we're calling up from sunup to sundown, which is pieces from our collection. We've been building a workers' culture collection here at the museum. And Kurt and I are co-curating an exhibit that we've been choosing different, both paintings, three-dimensional pieces and other things for the foyer, and that will go on next semester, late in the semester. But Nick McCuro and I are cooperating on an exhibit of the work of Nora Chapa Mendoza, which are paintings and other things that she does, some of which reflect on her experience and the experience of others as farm workers. And so, in fact, there's a piece of hers in today's presentation. So, do sign in, please, as I always indicate. And today, I'm going to do a presentation. Many of you asked me at the start when you were coming in, you know, isn't it about time you did one? This is actually the third that I've done over the period of the 17 years of the Brown Bag series. So the first one was the first Brown Bag was done with a handful of people talking about kind of the theoretical basis of all of this. Then there was one that was done in conjunction with our exhibit, Workers' Culture in Two Nations, South Africa and the United States, back a few years ago, and now this one. So I'm really happy that all of you showed up. And with that, let me give you a little bit of background on today's presentation, which is called The Way We Worked, The Culture and History of Work, Workers, and the Workplace. Now, the reason this presentation got put together is because of my current role as state scholar for the Michigan Humanities Council in their traveling exhibit called The Way We Worked. Now, The Way We Worked is a Smithsonian traveling exhibition, and on the Museum on Main Street project that happens out of the Smithsonian, what they do is they target putting museum exhibits into small towns. And so the exhibit is currently in Dowagiac, which I'll mention in this presentation. And it recently closed. It was up in, I'm blanking on the place, up near Alpena. It'll also be in Heartland, Escanaba, Clare, and Rogers City is where it started. So this presentation is the one that I'm taking around and doing across the state in conjunction with that exhibit. So let's talk together, and you know, feel free at any point along the way to ask questions or to stop me about the way we worked and this whole notion of workers' culture and the history of work and workers in the workplace. Many of the photos in the presentation are going to be from that exhibit. The paintings and other things I'll mention in turn. Naturally, this is a photo of back in the good old days, the way that we used to run telephone switchboards. So as we say in our daily work, our daily lives, work shapes our lives. When we meet strangers, our first question to most people that we meet is, what do you do? We're not really asking whether they ski, we're not asking whether they fish, we're not asking them whether or not they have an interest in gourmet foods. Instead, we really want to know and get inside, what do they do as work? Normally as paid work. That is, we want to know how they fit into kind of the economic life. Because so much of our identities is really, our identities are caught up in the whole notion of what we do as work, okay? And naturally, much of our work life is punctuated in terms of preparation for work. That is, what did we do in high school or college that prepared us for work or in an apprenticeship? Then we look at our work lives in terms of the different changes, and naturally we look at retirement. Retirement is defined as the time after work, right? And every retiree I know always says that they are working now more than they ever worked when they were working, right? So both on and off the job, we look at the effect that work has on us and how we both affect and effect our work. We talk, we complain, we celebrate, we struggle, all within this whole ambit of work. Our relationship to work is not only economic and social, it's cultural as well. Okay? Now these two photos are not from the exhibit. And Miles Rigovin was a photographer in upstate New York, Buffalo area. And what he decided to start doing is, he had been interested in photography for a long time, but he started a project where he was going to go into the steel mills and photograph some of his neighbors and others who were working in the mills. And Rigovin decided that he would do this, and he would ask the workers how they wanted to be posed. He would actually work with them in terms of having them take whatever pose they felt was really indicative of who they were. Then he did an interesting part of that project. He started first within the workplace, then he actually went to their homes as the second part of the project. And he would photograph them in their homes the way that they wanted to be understood and the way that they wanted to be captured. Now these are obviously are two different workers, but in the one case the workplace, the other case the home. With the understanding that the home is often an extension of the workplace. That is, work pays for our house. It pays for our standard of living. It pays for, the education of our children or anything else. It also often is a reflection of the fact that place is important because many times we have worked next to where we live. That is, in much of our upbringings, many of us were in walking cities, frankly, in original industrialization, where we walked to work or we were close enough to work that we, in effect, lived in the shadow of the factories. So our lives at work are defined in a number of ways. The many different locations in our lives, that is, where we work, where we live, where we operate as a union, if we're in a unionized environment, union halls, church basements, other kinds of things. The diverse roles, skills, and the people who fill and use them are parts of that whole lives at work definition. Defining ourselves and others by what we and they wear. We'll find out in a moment the difference between blue collar and white collar when we invented the notion of pink collar. So that whole notion of how what we wear actually indicates where we are in the pecking order of workers. What we eat, what we listen to in the way of music, and what we say at work, and the danger, solidarity, humor, irony, and meaning in hours spent together or alone in work. So all of those different things are this big soup of workers' culture, that is, the different kinds of understandings of ourselves and others through work. Yes, Tim?
What is going on in that picture?
This is people working in an early auto factory. So those are wheels that are being put together on the line. Back in the good old days when there was over 1,000% turnover in the Ford factories, for example, working on those kinds of... this is one of the photos out of the Way We Worked exhibit. So our personal and communal relations at work take many cultural and artistic forms, and they're expressed through poetry and narrative. Later today, I'll end with a poem from the auto worker Greg Chatwell. Sculpture and painting, music and dance, humor and drama, craft and representation. Through expressive culture, we integrate our occupation and our personal life. So many times what happens is that people have used the workplace as a way to then turn around and use that as the basis of their writing, as the basis of the writing of songs. Often, for example, in the history of the labor movement, taking well-loved hymns or well-known songs and putting new words on them, often humorously taking on the boss. And there are a number of examples of that in the history of labor and work music. So naturally, work doesn't only happen. Often we think of work as dirty occupations, that is factory work. You know, I personally came up through the paper factories. Others we think of auto factories or whatever. But naturally, white collar work or different forms of managerial work is work too. And a very, very good friend, Sheila Murphy, has edited an entire volume of poems by men and women of the corporation, different people within different parts of the hierarchy, and who also write poetry on the side. One recent poem that made it into the Lansing Online News during Poetry Month last year was written by Bob Trezise, who's the head of the Lansing Economic Partnership. So, I mean, it's interesting from the point of view of the people who you wouldn't necessarily think of as poets. Often our poets are fiction writers, often, again, reflecting on their work. So, sometimes we have simple photos, but sometimes photos become art. So that, in this case, you know, a good photo of the workplace, but on the right, one of Lewis Hine's photographs of someone, turning, in this case, a nut on a piece of machinery, has become one of the most iconic kind of photographs that we have that shows that kind of muscular work. So it's not so much only that there are representations of work. It's the fact that when you have something, it might actually cross the line into a representation that becomes artistic and somehow speaks to others. This very well may speak to many of us, but this ends up speaking very much profoundly, to what that work might feel like and how people understand the different kinds of work. This is one of the pieces that we own here at the MSU Museum. This is by Ralph Asinella. And I want to show you kind of counterpositions of both paintings and photos, and also talk about the different kinds of locations in which we work. So in this case, this is a painting called Braddock Lunch, but first I have to tell you about Fasanella. Ralph Fasanella fought in the Spanish Civil War on the side of the Republicans, that is, that he was a young communist that went from New York City to fight on that side, many of whom went into that specifically thinking that it was a precursor to World War II, that is, that they were fighting on the side of the Spaniards against Franco and the fascists, and they believed that this really was kind of the first step into fighting Hitler and fighting Mussolini and the rest. Fasanella was a machinist by background. And what he found was that as he was working in his occupation, that he was beginning to have problems with his hands. And so he went to his doctor, and his doctor suggested to Ralph, but what Ralph really might want to do is take up painting, because the fact that that might ease some of the problems that he was having with his fingers. So he went, and in Brooklyn, he went to the Brooklyn School of Art or whatever and took one of the nighttime classes that they had available. He didn't take many before he started painting, and is really regarded as, with Grandma Moses, much more self-taught rather than as a fine artist. But Fasanella became a union organizer, was blacklisted, worked for the UE, which was one of the unions that was thrown out of the CIO for being communist-led, and ultimately could not find work. So painted on the side, did various odd jobs, ultimately was found by New York Magazine as, in terms of his painting and everything else, while he was working at his brother-in-law's filling station as a gasoline attendant and doing other odd jobs around the place. But Braddock Lunch shows us all the complexion of those different relationships at work. In this case, you have a group of employees lining up to get lunch at the local, their earlier version of food trucks, back in this case in Pennsylvania, with a skyline dominated by factories, people who work, eat, you know, and live probably in the same neighborhood. Chances are very good that two or three of the buildings, if you go down this street, are probably taverns where folks stop after work to organize or to agonize over what work has been like. So this is one of Fasanella's that you'll see, and we own this one because of the bequest of Dan Fussfeld, a professor of economics at the University of Michigan, who, when he passed away, gave a large part of his folk art collection to the MSU Museum, which we're very, very happy with. Here, so going back, that's one version of a factory, right? And that's another version of a factory. Very, very different kind of counterpositions. This is one version of people working in the fields. This is one of the images from The Way We Worked of workers in California working in the fields. This is a Nora Chapa Mendoza. Nora is an artist in Detroit. She has done a number of paintings. This one happens to be called Meandering Stream. And if any of you look at the top of our stationery, of our flyer sheet, you'll see that one person's face out of this is used in our four piece of art head for our stationery. Meandering Stream shows herself or people like herself as agriculture workers marching toward the truck with their full baskets of tomatoes or whatever it is that they happen to be working with. A very different version, but very much the same as that. Then you have union location as part of your life. Many workers are unionized, less so today than they were at the height of the union movement in 1955, when 35% of the private sector workforce, for the most part, was unionized. Today, that figure is less, around 8%. Private sector, overall 11%. The 3% difference is public sector workers, who are around 37% organized here in the United States. So in this case, you have people in the trades. This is a march in commemoration of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire nearly 100 years ago in 1911, when a number of dressmakers in the shirtwaist factory were on an upper floor of a tenement building, and the boss thought it was a great idea not to let people get out for smoke breaks, so what he did is he chained all the doors and locked them. So when the fire started near the entrance, there was no way for those men and women to get out. Many of them died in the fire. Many of them actually jumped out of the windows, I think six or seven stories up, and died on the sidewalk rather than letting themselves be consumed by fire. But this is another version of the union. In this specific thing that we own here at the museum, this is another Fasanella. This one is called by him "Don't Mourn, Organize." Ralph is that man standing in the doorway, watching as this organizing committee meets in the local union hall. So you can see at the one upper left thing, it says CIO rally. So this is really from the 1950s, prior to the merger of the AFL-CIO in 55. But it also shows Ralph's sense of humor, because on the right it says build a rank and file union, right? If you look at only the uppercase, it says bar fun, right? And this specific fascinella was donated to the MSU Museum, and it's held in trust actually by three universities, Ferris State, Wayne State, and Michigan State University. And it was donated by United Food and Commercial Workers Local 951, the folks who work at Myers. And some of the Kroger stores on the left side of the west side of Michigan. Now, what is worker culture? Worker culture is really created out of three things. It's what workers, broadly defined, bring with them in terms of their background and culture, in terms of their skills. It comes out of what they actually create on the job, shared workplace culture, ways to get by, how we get through the boredom of the day, or how we watch the hours march on. And I'm going to give you examples of some of these in a moment. And then it's what they take home. So what do they take home? They take home new skills. They take home stories and perspectives that they didn't have before. And they take home what we call government work, or homers. And I'm going to show you some examples of those. Government work is those things that you make on the job, often with materials that basically you're stealing from the boss. That is a leftover, it might be leftover wood, it could be leftover metal, it could be a leftover ceramic, could be a variety of things. But you're making something that you can find either you find of interest, that is artistically, or of use, and you take it out of the factory with you after you work on it there. It could be, for example, that you're using their machines. Some people have brought materials into the workplace, machined them at work, and taken them back out. So there are a variety of examples. These are called government work generally, or homers. This specific piece, by the way, is called I Did It for Walter. John Wazalewski, if I always get that name right or wrong, Kurt. This is an image of his shop steward. And the reason it's called I Did It for Walter is this is a very famous union button called I Did It for Walter, which is a reflective button. If you turn it back and forth, it goes from Ruther's face to the term I Did It for Walter, right? And this is his shop steward then that he actually did in this form. But let's go through some of these things. Many workplaces, what people brought with them was common ethnicities. So here in Michigan, a lot of our different sections of factories or sections, specific work was dominated by specific work groups that were of a common ethnic heritage. So for example, in my native Upper Peninsula, naturally Finns, Slovenes, and others worked in the mines, and they worked in a hierarchy below Cornish and Welsh miners who were actually supervisors. So there was not only a difference and a divide based on their occupation, but there was a difference and divide based on their ethnicity. Yes, Jess?
In that previous picture, I noticed the women's striking, the waist,
there was
a look like a Hebrew.
Yes, so the Jewish workers dominated in the trades, in the needle trades in New York City. So many folks who came in from Eastern Europe who were Jews ended up working in the trades. Many of those locals ended up being Jewish workers coming in from Germany or coming in from Eastern Europe, Russia, around the turn of the century, before the turn of the 20th century, came with very, very strong socialist views. So they were the backbone not only of the Socialist Party, the Socialist Labor Party, but also the Communist Party as well. So many of those groups went through internal factional fights within the needle trades unions, the International Lady Garment Workers Union, or the Amalgamated Clothing Workers during that time frame in the teens and into the 20s and 30s. What many workers bring with them to the workplace is skills that they already have, skills that they learned from their parents. And some of those skills are things that, you know, that they use even though they were not necessarily taught on the job. That is, it might be that they learn certain carpenter skills or other kinds of skills within the family. Or they learn those skills because they followed their parents into the specific workplaces or occupations. In my case, I never became a blacksmith like my father, but I followed him into the paper mill. and I became a paper mill worker in the same mill where he worked. Now, what that does for you often is you have heard about the paper mill or the auto plant or the construction site your entire life. It's what you heard over the dinner conversation, or it's what you heard over breakfast. It's what you shared with your parents when you went to union picnics or company picnics, or it's what you shared with them when they went on strike. It's what you shared with them when they went through different kind of occupational accidents. Now, what do workers create there? They create shared workplace culture. So let me just mention my own time, and again in the factory. When I worked in the paper mill, every August the sweet corn would get harvested in the Upper Peninsula. And many of our workers were not only workers, they were also farmers. And when the sweet corn came in, what would happen is on the 3 to 11 shift, suddenly big vats of boiling water would just erupt all over the workplace. People would bring in hot plates, large cauldrons, and we would cook sweet corn and eat it with big slabs of butter and salt and sliced tomatoes until we were just food coma. You know, it makes Thanksgiving look like something light. But the whole point of that shared workplace culture, that was something that every worker within different parts of the paper mill would look forward to every August, because it was a part of the shared workplace culture of what it meant to work in that place. Also, what happens in a variety of different workplaces, and this is a generational shift that developed, is workers would not like it if younger workers came in with holes in their jeans or their clothes. They felt it was disrespectful to walk in with, in effect, holy jeans. And in many workplaces, there is a tradition that older workers would grab the offending leg or pocket or whatever, and basically rip the leg or whatever right off, make the hole bigger, forcing the person to come in dressed differently. Because of the fact that respect comes from looking right, speaking right, acting right. It comes from being a good worker. Much of the respect within workplaces is first and foremost that you know what you're doing and you can handle yourself on the job. And then part of that very well may be how you speak, what you say, what you wear, and so forth. Now, ways to get by. What's been true, as long as there have been workers and as long as there have been bosses, bosses have wanted more work out of workers, and workers have not wanted to necessarily do it the boss's way. And many times, bosses will tell workers what to do, and if workers did it the boss's way, no work would actually transpire and nothing could actually happen constructively. Workers have found shortcuts to make sure that they had a limited amount of time to themselves during the day, that they weren't necessarily doing work, they weren't necessarily thinking of it in the boss's fashion. So in that way, workers have always come up with shortcuts, workarounds, and different ways to actually get the work done, ways to get through the day, games that they played with one another, in effect. And this depends on whether or not the boss is in the workplace, because naturally, if the boss isn't there on the midnight shift, chances are very good you can get that novel read, right? Chances are you can get other stuff done. Otherwise, you have to look like you are constantly sweeping one more time. When they were in a struggle with Caterpillar, one of the UAW leaders of that got in trouble because of the fact that they did a skit as part of their training of people to actually resist the boss. And it was my favorite thing that he did. He showed a worker, and the worker is simply sweeping, you know, in a tight circle around where the time clock is. And the boss comes up and says, "What are you doing? I told you to work." And the worker looks back at the boss and said, "Yes, you told me to work around the clock." And he said, "And that's exactly what I'm doing." So ways to get by often is the humor that people create, stories, again, that they tell each other about what it means to be a worker. Naturally, what they take home, again, is new skills. Many workplaces create a skilled workforce. That is, the workers didn't walk in with those skills. And many of those skills are not transferable. That is, to run a paper machine, it's not like that transfers to other kinds of pieces of machinery. The same thing is true in terms of auto work and other things. And they come in with one set of perspectives and they go out with another. They very well may have come in with different feelings about authority, either good or bad, different feelings about different ethnicities, different feelings about what constitutes good work. And they very well may go home with very different perspectives after they've been a worker for a while. Now, government work in Homer's, I'm actually going to show you some examples of that as we go along. So let me talk about humor for just 2 seconds. So many turn to Dilbert each day as he mirrors their work frustrations and their small victories. I think it's interesting that an office worker, in effect, has become the image that we use now of resistance. In this case, of course, that wonderful haircut that she has. I proofread your technical document despite not understanding a word of it. I couldn't tell the acronyms for the typo, so I changed them all to what ever felt right. And the boss looks at Dilbert and says, you say we should migrate our lemon flutes to a hard flea. And of course, Dilbert says back, not all at once, right? So, and all of us look to Dilbert for our things. But here is one from MSU. I found this a few months ago. Many instead make it their own fun. So this is a velociraptor-free workplace. It has probably been 9 days since our last incident. Don't you love the sticky? Right, so we have to change it each time. I went in one day and it said zero. It has been 0 days since our last incident. By the way, this I won't tell you where this was up, but a few days later it was taken down and I haven't seen it up yet. And that was in a public place that was up. Now, we bring all of that complexity to the workplace and we reflect ourselves in a variety of different ways. I find this to be a wonderful photo. This is an example from our work and Kurt and Marsha's work here at the museum. This is a gospel choir at Chrysler Corporation in Detroit. So this is the gospel choir and they are singing on the shop floor to their coworkers. In that same Chrysler plant, they not only have a gospel choir, they also have a jazz band. Okay? So workers are able to reflect workplace culture in a variety of places, both on and off. This speaks not only, by the way, to their identity as workers. In this case, it speaks to their identity as religious people as well, right? And that kind of seamless, at times, interaction between all the domains of our life. White Shirt Day, our little bit of 1937 sit-down strike stuff. February 11th is the anniversary each year of the end of the sit-down strike when the UAW won the strike. And what the workers did on White Shirt Day is a few years after the strike, I believe that it was set up in, 47. In 1947, local union leader decided that to commemorate the anniversary of the sit-down strike, every worker on the floor had to wear a white shirt rather than a blue shirt that day. Because supervisors wear white shirts and workers wear blue shirts. So one day a year, all the workers wear white shirts to basically claim equality with their supervisors in that fashion. And in that way, White Shirt Day, in this case, is being celebrated within a local union hall. The wearing of white shirts really is emblematic of both commemorating the day and commemorating what it actually stands for. Now, I promised you some government work, and this is government work. Here they call it motor agate on the shop, on the website that sells these. It's known other places as Fordite. And what it is, this is, I'll pass it around, these are pieces of paint that build up on paint racks within the auto factories, or at least used to. And what they had to do is you would have to take the paint off of the racks periodically with the chisel and hammer. If you put this on a grinder and cut against the bias, against the buildup, what you end up with, as you'll see on this one, is an actual grain that makes it look much more like a piece of stone. So many of the workers here at General Motors, at Chrysler, and at Ford traditionally took these especially when they had bright colors that they were using. These are duller colors, and I'll just pass them around. But they would basically create jewelry, and many people put them then on pendants and would wear them. I saw one that was about that large. It was absolutely gorgeous that someone simply had kind of as a jewel. And these are extant almost every place where you've got some kind of paint operation. The problem with painting now is they use paint reclamation technologies within the auto plants. So this is no longer the reality of what happens with your paint racks. That is one bit of kind of lore and workers' culture that's falling by the wayside. Another Homer is this. You recognize this as a? You know, hood ornament. For a Cadillac, right? And this is a belt buckle. Because what happened is the hood ornaments started disappearing off the line and coming back on people's belts as belt buckles, okay? And so that's what that is, and we use this in one of our exhibits. Yeah, Joyce?
What's the name of that paint?
Well, they call it Motor Agate on their website. It's for sale. I mean, you can actually buy these things, but it's been called Fordite in some places, just for the fun of it. Okay, so those are both examples of what we call government work in Homer's, because it's not like the boss is saying, I'd really like you to make a belt buckle out of your hood ornament today, nor are they saying, I want you to walk away with those paint chips and turn them into jewelry, right? So in that case, it's quite inventive in both cases. Here in our area, and Kurt and Marcia are very famous for one of their first pieces of research, Grand Ledge workers, where they were making ceramic sewer pipe and other things, they took the time from making that clay pipe to fashion other fired objects out of the leftover clay. So they would make the Grand Ledge lions, they would make frogs, turtles, and other kinds of things, in effect, that if you have a little leftover clay, you know, that's what you're going to produce. Now, a similar thing happens in almost any factory where there's leftover materials. So in Dowagiac, they used leftover iron from the creation of stoves in the Dowagiac factory to make different items. This one is called a Naughty Nelly, okay? Now, I've actually found these. This is you can find any of these on the internet. These happen to be owned by the museum in Dowagiac. Naughty Nellies are bootjacks, is what they are. And I think that they were creating them based on a mold that already existed. But I find this one to be far more interesting. During the outbreak of World War II, the factory got turned to ordnance creation out of Dowagiac, and the man who worked in the factory ran into a problem because he bought a toy gun for one of his two sons, but he couldn't get the second toy gun that he needed. So he used leftover material at the Dowagiac factory to fashion a second gun for his son, toy gun for his other son for Christmas. And these are all currently existing in the museum over in Dowagiac. So the frog and again, these were made by workers when they had time on their hands and leftover materials. This is an example from the Upper Peninsula. This is from the copper country. So that somebody decided to simply start making whirligigs, as they're often called, things that you put on your front lawn. Naturally, the wind blows and the miner mines, right? And made this image of a miner. You have to ask yourself the question, I guess this is what it really comes down to, all of this reason that many of us look at workers' culture. You know, people can do anything. He could have, you know, created a situation where a farmer is hoeing a row of flowers, It could be anything, but what makes us try to replicate our work experience and have it reflected, in effect, in our artistic experience and, in this case, on our front lawn? This is a recent example. Maybe many of you have seen this in my emails, I hope. This is at a corner of U Street, and I can't remember the other street, in Washington, D.C. Recently, this was put up. That is the famous iconic image of the I Am a Man picket line in the Memphis garbage workers' strike in 1968. Now, the reason that that strike is significant, of course, is that's the strike where Martin Luther King came in to speak on behalf of the workers and was shot by James Earl Ray. But I find it interesting that, again, to be able to take an iconic worker photograph, in this case, a photograph of struggle, and to put it on a major public street in Washington, D.C., around a building that's going through rehabilitation. French artists did this because of the fact that he felt that it made sense. And if you know that area of Washington, D.C., it was traditionally an African-American area of Washington, D.C. as well, so it makes a lot of sense. Now, commemoration, therefore, again, it was once said that the reason that the Vietnam Vet Memorial made sense historically is that Native Americans in the Northeast used to dig a hole to commemorate that something happened in this location. And not that they would do anything with the hole, they just thought that a hole was important. So commemoration, by its very nature, we commemorate strikes, we commemorate great people who have passed away. We commemorate a variety of things because, frankly, sometimes in the workplace, it is about death. It is about loss of limbs. It can be around a variety of things. So one commemoration that we had here at Michigan State University is this one. And this commemoration was only exhibited a number of places in the United States. We happen to be one of them. We now own this quilt. This quilt was created by the American Federation of Government Employees, and each one of these quilt squares represents one of the workers who showed up for work the day that the Murrow Building was destroyed by Timothy McVeigh's bomb. And each one of these quilt squares represents that worker based on something that that the quilter, individual quilters did each of these squares, volunteer quilters. And in some cases, they knew the person personally and they made the quilt square. In other cases, they learned about the person through other people that knew them. And they created a unique quilt square for each one of the people that were killed while they were on the job as federal workers. This is the a part of the state flag of the state of Oklahoma. So because the AFGE decided as part of their design to commemorate the fact that it happened in the state of Oklahoma. So that's why they did that specific commemoration. This was in the lobby here at our administration building. And it was one of the places where it was publicly displayed. Ultimately, it was meant to hang in the new federal building in Oklahoma City, and for some reason, they made the decision not to do that. So we were able to have it donated to the MSU Museum for our permanent quilt collection and for our workers' culture collection because it was sitting in a box underneath one of their conference table kind of areas in the union headquarters because they didn't know what they were going to do with it. They wanted. And we told them that we would make sure it had a good home at Michigan State University with the rest of our quilt collection, which is one of the best quilt collections and most well-known quilt collections, frankly, on Earth, in a public museum. So, let me end and then open up to questions. Oh, I'm going to do this and then I'm going to end with something else. So why is all this stuff important, right? Work, like love and death, is one of the great frames, canvases, and tapestries of our life. There are only so many great themes, love, death, redemption, work. But for some reason, work often gets shunted aside, like it's not worthy, like those other great kind of passing parts of our life, even though we spend more time at work than we do in any other part of our day. We spend more time at work than we do with our family. We spend more time at work than we do with our friends. We spend more time at work than we do in artistic or other kind of pursuits. Our understanding of our lives and the lives of others is not as rich or as incomplete if we do not mine this vein, if we don't understand what goes on with work. Workplaces and lives of all the people who work there are works in progress. That is, it's not so much that we can understand a worker only as that we understand an auto worker as only an auto worker. We have to understand them in all of his or her complexities. They're ever-changing, deserving attention, and absolutely replete with possibility. So let me end with this poem. And this poem was written as a blessing, and it's by Greg Shotwell. Greg has a rather interesting experience personally. He is one of the finest little writers I've ever seen. He's a very, very talented writer. He's a blogger, done a variety of things in his life as a UAW member, and he's one of the strongest UAW dissidents that exists within the UAW. And I once read this poem out loud to a UAW gathering and was heavily scored for doing that by the head of the UAW in that specific region, because he said, "Don't you know who Greg Shotwell is?" I said, "Well, it's a damn fine poem." He goes, "I don't care." And so let me read this poem to you to end, and then I'll open it up for questions. This is called "The World Is in Their Care" by Greg Shotwell. Bless the laborers who rise before dawn. Bless the short order cook who greets them. Bless the carpenter, the roofer, the wireman. We are distraught and homeless without them. Bless the fitter of pipes, the maker of barrels, the sweeper of chimneys. Bless the iron worker, the steeplejack, those builders of bridges whose reach exceeds our grasp. Bless the maker of tools, to whom all workers are grateful. Bless the tinsmith's pandemonic racket, the painter's tinctured grin, the fire in the heart of the mason. Bless the reverence of the logger who hears the tree fall deep in the forest of our collective memory. Bless the flame in the eye of the welder. Bless the high beam trance of the long haul trucker and the stevedore. Without them, the goods would never arrive. Bless the ambulance driver who never panics. Bless the garrulous cabbie who knows the score and beats the light. Bless the midwife, the tutor, the subway busker who honor our transitions. Bless the florist in times of romance and gratitude and death. Bless the veterinarian who rescued the animal you loved, honored, and respected. Bless the nurse who volunteers for overtime in intensive care. Bless the operator who answered the suicide hotline and listened with compassion and regard. Bless the fingers and hands, arms and shoulders, back and buttocks, legs and ankles and feet of the masseuse. Bless the patience of the orderly walking arm in arm with the victim of Alzheimer's who wanders in an endless maze of unfamiliar halls where doors lack handles and windows without views reflect faces without names. Bless the daycare worker who protects and nurtures children and deserves higher wages than the president. Bless the teacher who discovers you are brilliant. Bless the coach who sees potential where none existed before. Bless the children making toys in China for the children of America. Bless the migrants who labor in fields without citizenship or protection from pesticides and predatory contractors. Bless assembly line workers shackled with repetitive trauma and management's totalitarian mantra. Bless the union organizer, Clito Negro, shot and killed in Cuautitlan, Mexico, January 8, 1990, by pistoleros hired by the Ford Motor Company to crush the union. Bless the organizer again and again because the struggle never ends. Bless the librarian who finds the book I am looking for. Bless the attorney who defends the poor on principle pro bono and goes home to an empty house. Bless the pastor who kneels at the crossroad of struggle and flight. Bless the reporter who questions authority, gets the facts straight, the quote true, and the bullshit nailed. Bless the cutters and weavers and sewers of clothes. We are threadbare and cold without them. Bless the secretary who takes no shit and are fired and are called bitch. We need more of them. Bless the laundress who vanishes stains and rescues esteem to our wear and tear. Bless the feet of the cashier, the soles of the letter carrier, the toes on the shoulder of the grave digger's shovel. Bless the firefighter's widow, the miner's sorrow, the sailor's corse. Bless the discarded people who collect bottles and cans. Bless the janitor, the trash hauler, the sleep-deprived snowplower clearing away. Bless the grace of the waitress in the face of our hunger and alone and fear of aloneness in the hour of our need. Bless the baker who prepares our daily bread while we sleep. Bless the veteran of foreign wars who marches for peace, who sleeps in the mission, who weeps in the shadow of unknown soldiers he never forgets. Bless all who repair, restore, and refurbish. Bless the gleaners and gardeners, the children of farmers selling apples and pears in the open-air market. Bless all who labor and those whom they love. Shelter and protect them, now and forever. The world is in their care. Thank you very much. So, any questions or comments on this presentation? The floor is open. Oddly enough, Craig, you were listening in on yesterday's conversation on this very matter. Yes, I think that perhaps those of us who use work to form a major part of identity, that that is now shifted, that the current generation of youth coming up do not feel about this in the same way. And let me use one quick example that I think you'll find interesting, and that's Fiat workers. Fiat workers in Italy, in the early 1980s, were interviewed about work. And what they said was real interesting, because the fact that when asked, what do you do, Fiat workers did not normally say, oh, I work at Fiat. They would say instead, oh, I ski. Because they did not want people to pigeonhole them based on identity. And many folks have claimed that what I laid out today is an American affectation besides a time-bound American affectation, so that Americans are far more worried about this definition of ourselves as work than almost, you know, a lot of other people across the globe who don't think of themselves in that exact fashion. So I think that you're absolutely right. Now, whether or not that kind of negotiation of identity, how work is going to fit into that in the future very well may be a different thing. And as a person, a sociologist, by the way, who I was talking this over last night at dinner, night before at dinner, said that she now qualifies that when she asks people, what do you do, she even adds the words, for work, to the sentence, because of the fact that she wants to make clear what is the actual question that she's asking. But I think that you're on to something that very well may be that we are a historic moment here at the museum in terms of trying to capture something now that is fleeting away, kind of workers' culture and work identity as a prime motivator. Sure?
Mm-hmm. Or I work in textiles. So, and the same is true in, with say, well, my ancestors were from Europe, or they might say East Lansing, or they might say, I don't really have a home, depending on what they think the reaction would be from the person.
Well, let's use the latter part of what you said, military brats. Who were raised in a variety of different places across the United States, often when people say, well, where are you from? They'll say, well, at one point in my life, right? So it does, and maybe we're sometimes worried about the idea that the answer that we give, what does it say in the mind of the person that we're giving that answer to? If I say, I'm an auto worker, if you're from Detroit, that very well may build a solidarity. If you happen to be from some place that doesn't have an auto plant, maybe that brings up all sorts of dark images in your mind of what an auto plant is like, right? So I think you're absolutely right. It depends on the audience and the shorthand that we might use, right? Now, Hermann Hesse, most famous for the novels Siddhartha and Steppenwolf, wrote a series of novels about a character called Nulp. And the interesting thing that Nulp did is that he would clothe himself in the language of occupations. So he would go into a community, he was a vagabond, and he could fall in with a group of masons, for example, and he knew how to talk like a mason, or he knew how to talk like a stonecutter, or he knew how to talk like whatever. But these people would look at him and they'd say, but your hands have no blisters, your hands have no calluses, you can't possibly be one of us. But so he was, in effect, flying like a bird of the same feather, when in reality he wasn't. So it's an interesting thing about how we use these different identities and what we assume of someone based on how they might speak, what kind of accent someone has and what that means to you one way or another, and where what they do for work. I saw another hand over here. Yes, Renee.
Yeah.
It's really bad when you know everyone in the room, isn't it? Yes.
That temple elements, mm-hmm. was referred, that post-modern era view of the contradiction in capital, mm-hmm. in terms of where the contested terrain is, mm-hmm. in the workplace, and contrast that with the idea of identity then taking place in that turf. Versus postmodern perspective, where one can envision the shift of that contested terrain to be the community.
Mm-hmm.
And the identity is now in terms of place and community versus workplace or interests around those two types of identities. Union versus community.
Well, but let's play with that in terms of Robert Reich wrote a piece called Who Is Us?
Right.
And then he wrote another one called Who Is Them? Because he was really, for Harvard Business Review, he was trying to explore this whole notion of if you're doing dualities, like who's the enemy, right? And he was really talking about global trade and other things in that way. But if it's community, community is now an imagined kind of thing that we sometimes create. I mean, many of our children have more community in terms on Facebook than they ever had in the neighborhoods of our towns. Or they are in touch with a variety of different people. So the notion of community, it might even be that geographic community now pales by comparison when we think about it in terms of that contested terrain. So how much is the blogosphere, how much is the internet now the basis of that contested terrain?
Well, both the labor and the geographic space are elements of economic stability.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about creating economic stability.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only place and or community geographically defined and the shop,
mm-hmm.
that have that in common. Other mm-hmm. forms of community don't necessarily impact that concept of community knowledge.
Right. So the issue really, like we were just playing with each other, the issue of how much does geography dominate at all notions of creation or should, and especially now that people are doing telecommuting and other things, again, who are they in solidarity with, and what are the bases of the kind of relationships that they might have? And how do you build referent groups? Workplaces were easy because I was working side by side with this person and I was dependent upon him or her. What happens when we're now building, you know, what are the bonds of solidarity or community or commonality if I'm not dependent on that person for something, for the handoff or whatever it happens to be? Gene? Except that I think that I would say that for some people it was the basis of building power, though, which humanized them for the first time. That is, that if I have economic power, then I have status, I have identity. It very well may be that before, you know, I had none. And I mean, I understand about the dehumanizing thing, that is, that it's essentializing them in a way. Charlie King, who you know, wrote a folk song where the refrain is, my job is more than my work, and my life is more than my job. So trying to create concentric circles around that idea of really what humanizes us. Many people, I think, have always looked at work as dehumanizing, and therefore the humanizing element is everything that happens away from work.
Mm-hmm. And what the function of that work might be socially. Mm-hmm. I mean, like working in a bond factory, for an easy example. I mean, it may be work, but it may not be positive.
Right. Right, yeah, and so that we get into whole issues of what constitutes right work, right, or good work. And sometimes that's been defined not only by what I'm doing, but what I get for it. Good work can be defined by, do you have a living wage, do you have benefits and other stuff, so there's a whole, am I respected at work? You know, and there's a lot of things caught up with that. Yes?
I want to shift that conversation just a little bit and talk about and ask for some suggestions about how people, when they first enter a new job, a new position, how they find out what are the ropes to jump and the ropes to skip, which things they can do, which suggestions they can make, which how much latitude they have in making the decisions that they do to either do a job as it's set out,
mm-hmm.
Who are the informal or formal leaders that they listen to, whom do they ignore,
mm-hmm.
What rules do they adhere to, what mistakes do they make that forever, typecast them.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's good research on a lot of that. And naturally, I mean, I think the thing that we have to put out right away is it depends on if you're black or white. It depends on if you're male or female. And that in many workplaces, for example, it very well may be that our group did some consulting there, they had a problem because the fact that they would go into staff meetings, they would talk, suddenly it would turn to football. And then all the women would get up and leave thinking the meeting was over. And the minute all the women were out, one of the guys would go, oh, by the way, did I tell you about those job openings that are coming up? And so they were using the privileging of voice and specifically some kind of things to sector off who had power and who didn't have power in the workplace. So there's a lot of stuff about insider, outsider, but also how do you make somebody an insider? And what's often true, I think workplaces are different than neighborhoods this way, that when we moved into our house won't become the Beck house until we sell it and move. We will forever be the Becks living in the Schwillies house, right? Whereas in the workplace, you graduate. You know, when you become a good man in the field, that is, that somebody says that you can actually be depended upon. I think there's a different kind of relationship in that it's not simple notation. There's a graduation that comes out of showing that you can actually do what needs to be done. So I hand back here. Craig?
Thinking about your main theme here, that just that if, you know, the original framing is the ways we work. Well, okay, if it's all we, then I'm wondering to what extent many of the things that you said would apply, especially to women who were working in more stereotypically women's occupations at various points in this history that you're covering here. Would they apply, would the things that you said apply differently than they would for men? Would they be less true for, less accurate for women than for men?
Well, let me play with you back, Craig, in a different, let me answer the question in a different way. To what degree is work identity moderated and mediated whether or not someone has work-family kinds of things? That is, women who left the workplace to be able to raise a family, or people who came back to the workplace. I mean, I think it's fairly telling that when the DOL started doing funding for women who were forced to come back into the workforce, they called them displaced homemakers. Right? These were not workplace entrants. These were displaced homemaker kind of funds that were available for women who had never worked outside of the home, per se. So I think that you're absolutely, you know, dead on the idea that someone very well may define themselves quite differently. But I would argue that women that work in beauty shops have a workers' culture. Women who work in diners have a workers' culture. They define themselves in relation to their work. That doesn't mean that they wrap their entire identity around work to the degree that someone else might, right? You know, and isn't it interesting? I mean, you know, to what degree can a priest take off his collar or her collar? To what degree, you know, do people in effect leave a certain workplace and leave a uniform behind? You know, the idea that when a cop is out of uniform, what does that mean about him or her at that point? And some occupations, people can never leave them. That is, that even when they're out of uniform, a cop is probably still a cop. Especially if they're a sworn officer, it very well may mean, you know, specific things in relation to their life. So I think you're right that gender has dimensions to this. And I think that watching my own children, the earlier thing that you raised is real interesting in terms of to what degree are they even going to allow themselves to be defined by work?
Right.
Or to what degree are they believing that their identity comes first and that they will create their own identity and they will take that identity to the variety of locations in their lives, and their work is not necessarily going to in effect mold them in the same way that it would a naughty Nelly, right? So that's a very interesting question. Other questions or comments? Questions or comments? Okay. Come back and thanks for coming today, and thanks for being part of this. Thanks for all of you who have come to many this year. We'll see you in 2013, January 18th. For Janine Lanza from Wayne State. So thanks for coming.